Well, good morning. Welcome to Between the Covers. My name is Bruce Silverman, and today I have in the studio Daniel Orozco. Mr. Orozco is a writer of fiction, most of the time anyway, and also a teacher of creative writing. And his first collection of short stories has just come out, although he's been writing for a long time. Daniel Orozco, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to be here. Thank you.
This collection that has just come out is called Orientation, and it's named after the first story in the book, which is not a new story, but I remembered it from reading it in a collection some years ago, and we're even going to have you read a few paragraphs from it. You've been writing stories and getting published in magazines for quite a while. How long?
I guess since 1994, so do the math, but I can't do the math.
17 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Why has it taken so long to get published in book form?
Well, there are a couple of things for that. I'm a very slow writer. I've always been very slow and rather meticulous. And as a result, I never really thought I'd get a short story collection published because I never had enough for a short story collection. I mean, as you can see, it's a small book. It's a slim tome. The other reason is essentially while I was publishing stories in magazines, I had people in the industry asking me. They liked my work. They would contact me, and then they would say, "We love your stories. Where's your novel?" And I tell them, "I don't have a novel." And for the longest time, I was kind of I kept hearing the conventional wisdom is that short stories don't sell, and they really weren't interested in selling a collection. They wanted to do a novel. So I guess those two factors are what made this take so long.
Okay. Well, the stories in this collection, Orientation, they vary quite a bit. The characters live very different lives. The stories are told in different ways, first person, third person, and even the recounting of a police blotter. Mm-hmm. I don't know what person that is. But I think we're going to need to ask you to read from two different stories.
Okay.
And let's go to the first one.
Okay.
From Orientation, the title story. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you to read just the first few paragraphs.
All right. Will do. Those are the offices and these are the cubicles. That's my cubicle there. And this is your cubicle. This is your phone. Never answer your phone. Let the voicemail system answer it. This is your voicemail system manual. There are no personal phone calls allowed. We do, however, allow for emergencies. If you must make an emergency phone call, ask your supervisor first. If you can't find your supervisor, ask Philip Spears, who sits over there. He'll check with Clarissa Nix, who sits over there. If you make an emergency phone call without asking, you may be let go. These are your in and out boxes. All the forms in your inbox must be logged in by the date shown in the upper left-hand corner, initialed by you in the upper right-hand corner, and distributed to the processing analyst whose name is numerically coded in the lower left-hand corner. The lower right-hand corner is left blank. Here's your processing analyst numerical code index, and here's your forms processing procedures manual. You must pace your work. What do I mean? I'm glad you asked that. We pace our work according to the 8-hour workday. If you have 12 hours of work in your inbox, for example, you must compress that work into the 8-hour day. If you have 1 hour of work in your inbox, you must expand that work to fill the 8-hour day. That was a good question. Feel free to ask questions. Ask too many questions, however, and you may be let go. That is our receptionist. She is a temp. We go through receptionists here. They quit with alarming frequency. Be polite and civil to the temps, learn their names, and invite them to lunch occasionally, but don't get close to them, as it only makes it more difficult when they leave. And they always leave. You can be sure of that.
And on and on. Someone's first day in the job. This sounds very familiar. None of this would likely be said out loud in the real world, but it sure would be thought.
Yeah. I did that work for about 10, 12 years. And it was work with very nice people, very decent people in a very constricted, constrained environment. I mean, the notion, for instance, which we take for granted, of having to show up at 8 and leave at 5, and somebody there whose job is to make sure that you show up at 8 and leave at 5, the breaks, the lunch hour, which you can't combine them. The breaks can be taken away, but the lunch hour can't. It's a kind of a constraint that seems necessary in the workplace, but felt to me, in writing this story, it felt unnatural. Once I was focusing on it, it felt bizarre. It felt absurd. That's one of the interesting things about writing and about working on this particular story orientation, is it kind of transforms the experience.
Yeah, you used the word absurd. Yeah, as I think about it now, this is right out of Kafka, but it's so plausible. I mean, I have worked in this place.
Yes, so have I.
Yeah, and probably most of the listeners, or at least worked there for the first day. We won't be able to have you read the whole book. That's for the listeners to do. But I can tell folks that you chronicle the events of people's lives rather than preaching sermons about their morals. Do I have that right? Is that something intentional, or am I wrong, or what?
No, how do I put this? I don't like being didactic in stories. I mean, I always, as a writer and as a teacher, I always instill the notion of dramatizing, of basically the truism of showing rather than telling. You want your reader to experience the story rather than simply understand it. To compel them to understand it is to start explaining things. But to experience allows for ambivalence and ambiguity that works dramatically. So it is a purposeful thing I try to do, although I sometimes have third-person narrators who do a lot of talking and explaining. So,
But you do recognize, obviously, that you can be as specific in your details as you want, but every reader is going to read it differently.
Yes, absolutely. And I do hear that when I do readings, these wonderful... I do believe in a certain extent in reader response theory, which is once the story is out there, it's kind of not yours anymore. The story is being created between the words on the page and the reader reading them. So
in their mind's eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, I found the characters in all your stories to be very real, their actions to be plausible. Is that important to you? I mean, could you do something that the reader just has to allow for implausibility? Could you do science fiction or something?
I think I kind of do it in orientation when things kind of go a little, when the office tour goes a little weird. Mm-hmm. And I do it in Officer's Weep. To me, somebody asked me once, who's the audience for your stories? And I really don't think about an audience. I think the audience is somebody in a far corner of my head. To a great extent, writing for me, this sounds awful to say, but writing for me is a kind of self-serving endeavor. And the hope is that you find your reader. People who read and experience the story in the same way that to the same intent in which I wrote it.
That might be very few people.
It might be. Yeah.
I know it would be for me. So you do have a reader in mind, or is that reader you?
I think the reader's me. It is everything about for me, everything about writing a story is being so much inside my head. For instance, very often, before I even work on a story, I'll be thinking about it for months, 6 months. I won't even know it's a story I want to work on, but it's just some sort of scenario, some sort of narrative problem that I can't stop thinking about. And after 6 or 8 months, I'll start writing it and I'll finish it.
So then are you the first person in all these stories?
Am I the first person narrator?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So, well, if not, okay, let's take the one that's basically a police blotter.
Right.
Of the events of one shift, actually more than one shift, with two cops in a cop car.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing you haven't been a police officer.
No.
Okay. Did you research it? Did you go for a drive along or something so you can get the right atmosphere in your story? Can you write about someone's life that you've never lived or even a part of it, their working life? Or is that impossible? Some writers do it wonderfully well, and you wonder, how did they know all that?
Yeah. Somebody asked a question of a colleague of mine, Michael Byers. He wrote a collection of short stories called The Coast of Good Intentions, and many of the stories were from the perspective of elderly people in their 70s and 80s. And Michael's 25 when he wrote that, and they asked him that question. How do you know so much about the experience of the elderly and you're so young? And he said, frankly, he wasn't being flip. He said, I'm a writer and I made it up. In other words, I think the challenge of writing is not necessarily to write about what you know, but to write about what you want to know, to write about what fascinates you. I could never write directly about my own experience. Many of my friends and colleagues are very good, not autobiographical writers, but they tap events in life. And I don't think I could do that. For me, that would feel like transcription. I have to transform. And in order to do that, I have to come up with something that lets me go into the story writing process and transform it. I mean, I could argue that every story that I write is about me, simply because I wrote it. But to say that they're autobiographical would be, you know, kind of off the mark.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to read a bit from another story, basically to show the listeners how diverse the perspectives and the characters are, and the storytelling. And this one, we're following what goes through someone's mind, basically. This is from a story called The Bridge. It's about a man. He's a bridge painter on the Golden Gate Bridge, and his nickname is Baby. He sees a woman jump. He's painting underneath the deck of the bridge where the sidewalk is on the Golden Gate. And so this woman jumps from above. He doesn't see that, but she passes by his eyes for a moment, a second. And here we get a description of what goes on in his mind and what he sees and what he thinks.
All right. The witnesses said she dived off the bridge head first. They said she was walking along when she suddenly dropped her book bag and scrambled onto the guardrail, balancing on the top rail for a moment, arms over her head, then bouncing once from bended knees and disappearing over the side. It happened so fast, according to one witness. It was a perfect dive, according to another. But her trajectory was poor. Too close to the bridge, her foot smashed against a beam, spinning her around and pointing her feet and legs downward. She was looking at Baby as she went past him, apparently just as surprised to see him as he was to see her. She was looking into his face, into his eyes, her arms upstretched, drawing him to her as she dropped away. And wondering how you decide to remember what you remember, wondering why you retain the memory of one detail and not another, Baby would remember running those 2 seconds over and over in his head, her hands reaching toward him, fingers splayed, and her left hand balling into a fist just before the fog swallowed her. He would remember a thick, dark green pullover sweater and the rush of her fall, bunching the green under her breasts, revealing a thin, pale waist and a fluttering white shirt tail. He would remember bleached blue jeans with rips flapping at both knees and basketball shoes, those red high tops that kids wear, and the redness of them arcing around, her legs and torso following as she twisted at the hips and straightened out, knifing into the bed of fog below. But what he could not remember was her face. Although he got a good look at her at one point, just about nose to nose, no more than 6 inches away, it was not a clear, sustained image of her face that stayed with him, but a flashing one, shutter clicking, on and off in his head. He could not remember a single detail. Her eyes locked on his as she went past and down, and baby could not, for the life of him, and however hard he tried, remember what color they were.
That was Daniel Orozco reading from a story called The Bridge in his new collection, Orientation. He'll be reading tonight at Powell's Books on Hawthorne. I was timing you. That took about 130 seconds to read an account of what went past a guy's eyes and through his mind in about 1 second. The human mind covers more ground in 1 second than any computer could.
Yeah, it can get pretty infinite. One of the tools and techniques that a writer becomes familiar with is manipulating time and chronology. I mean, one of the definitions of a story is events moving causally in sequence through time, and it's not necessarily a chronological sequence. You can go forward, you can leap backward, you can collapse decades in a sentence, and you can expand 2 seconds, 1 or 2 seconds to 130 or even more. So Nicholson Baker has a great model for that in his first novel, The Mezzanine, which is about an escalator ride that takes about 20 seconds, and he's written a 110-page novel about he steps on the bottom of the escalator at the beginning, and at the end he gets off at the top, and the rest is just, as Virginia Woolf put it, the theater of the mind, what he thinks about that day, what he's been doing, and it's really, really quite a wonderful tour de force, and that's something I've always admired about Baker and about his work, is that absolute manipulation, there's no other word for it, of chronology that becomes so dramatically compelling.
I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I've been asking you about developing a character and creating a story. But yeah, the manipulation of time, absolutely, in any fiction, even in telling true stories, whether it's writing a book or making a movie, the writer or the filmmaker does have the luxury of playing around with time. Mystery writers certainly do that. They also manipulate how much they will reveal of what's known by the police or whatever. Mm-hmm. They let that out in pieces. Mm-hmm. But any novelist and any short story writer, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Withholding information. I think it's one of the reasons why I prefer third person over first person, because first person narration, the perspective of the drama is a single character. And you're, frankly, for good effects, confined to that one perspective. And I think, enjoy the kind of the power and the scope and the choices that can be made in third person, because you can basically kind of go anywhere you want. And I kind of like that challenge.
Well, more choices and more limitations. The short story form, it's got to be fairly short.
Yes.
Versus the novel. First of all, do you have a novel in the works or what?
I do. I am working on a novel that I've been writing for about 4 or 5 years, and it should be done, at some point.
Okay. Differences in the genres from the writer's point of view?
Well, to be frank, I reluctantly started writing a novel. Again, I started about 5 years ago, and this was a point where nobody was really quite interested enough in the short story collection. And I decided, this seems to be a kind of necessity of publishing to have a novel in the wings. And that's the only reason I started writing it. And now I actually enjoy working on it. The long form, multi-stranded narrative is—it's something that never really appealed to me. And now I'm really, really interested in seeing if I can pull it off. I love the short story form. I think it's the purest and most distilled narrative form. There's something so complete and crystallized about it. Novels are interestingly baggier, and that's not a diss on novels. I think they kind of have to be. They have to be expansive and a little more open. And I'm enjoying that, but I'd like to write another short story at some point.
Well, another short story collection, you mean?
No, just another short story.
Oh, okay. Well, I just had this impression that you were coming out with them every week. But the form, though, you mentioned publishers. The short story form keeps being declared dead by publishers. They don't sell. We don't want to publish them.
Mm-hmm.
And then every time a good collection comes out, at least one of the reviewers or one of the people who's written a blurb for the back of the book says, the short story form has been rejuvenated. What's with the form these days? Do you want to defend it or watch it die or watch it reborn?
As far as I can remember, I've been reading and hearing that the short story form's been dying and being reborn since the mid-70s, you know.
At least.
Yeah, at least. I think they'll always be here. I mean, it'll never be a money maker. I mean, creating art is the anomaly. How do I put this? It's not about making money. It's just, again, for me, it's about finding my reader who liked it the way I did and wants to put it out there. Publishing is there. I've met many wonderful people in publishing. They've helped me immensely. They've been very kind to me. But most publishing companies are owned by conglomerates, and they're looking at a bottom line. And I think the trick to finding a good publisher is having the people that you deal as a writer you deal with, they keep that away from you. They want you to do your work, and then they can worry about that bottom line stuff. And so, I think, frankly, that having a novel in the wings was fairly helpful in getting this short story collection published.
Uh-huh.
So
is the same publisher interested in your novel? Is
that yes.
It? I see.
Yeah.
Okay. One other part of your life is that you teach writing. You teach creative writing at University of Idaho. I'll just ask this straight out. Is it possible to teach writing successfully? Can you create a writer?
I think you can create. You may not be able to create a good writer, but you can create a better writer. My whole goal in teaching an undergraduate writing class is not to move through the room and separate the good from the bad and baptize the writers and tell them, okay, you may move on into the writing world. The rest of you, you'll need to do something else. I tend to teach writing as the flip side of reading. Teach that whatever you do as a writer, it's going to make you a better reader. And to experience a work from the perspective of someone who's producing it is invaluable. And so that's kind of how I teach the writing class.
Well, you teach at a state university. Hopefully the students have gotten decent grades before or some kind of good student.
Mm-hmm.
Do they excite you? I mean, or at least one per class? I mean, is it still fun? Do you have hope?
I do. I do still enjoy teaching. I mean, if I didn't enjoy it, you can't fake it. You can't pretend you like being there because they can tell. And regardless of the level of writing, it's the level of engagement and discussion that excites me. I really like having students be excited about something that they've read and trying to articulate what it was about that work that excited them. That's engaging with a work of art, with a piece of literature. And when I have students doing that does it for me. That does it.
Okay. Last question, putting you back maybe in the your role as a student.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other writers who have been influential on you, either intentionally or you realized later on that you'd just written something that resembled someone else that you respect?
Yeah, there are a few. Well, I mentioned Nicholson Baker, and there's another writer called Ron Hansen, who wrote a book called The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. And what I love about those two books, what I admire so much about them, is the level of detail that they use to immerse you in the world of character. An incredible level of research, in Baker's case, an almost obsessive, compulsive attention to detail. And I love that texture. And I've written some stories, I think Officers Weep and Somoza's Dream, that are steeped in research, that not just for the sake of research, but that I truly believe like work to texture and deepen the drama. And I can't say enough about Concrete Detail, and I think those two have been models for me in how to approach making a world concrete and real and tangible that people are moving through.
You mentioned Somoza's Dream, which is in this collection, Orientation. I wouldn't have thought that I had anything in common with the ex-dictator of Nicaragua, Anastasio Somoza. But this is a description of a short period in his life in exile, a decadent life. And boy, I could believe every word of it. You know, I wouldn't be him before or after, but it was so real because of the detail.
Oh, great.
So,
yeah.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole collection. The collection is Orientation, a book of stories by Daniel Orozco, who is going to be reading tonight at Powell's on Hawthorne at 7:30 p.m. You've been listening to Between the Covers. Stay tuned next for Natalie Butto, who will be talking about film festivals. My name is Bruce Silverman. Thanks for listening to the KBOO Radio Zine.